Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, accepting nominations now for the 2020 James Irvine Foundation Leadership Awards at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, featuring Listening to Mothers in California, a new survey with insights into maternity care in the Golden State, on the web at chcf.org.
Today on Valley Edition, we examine an unusual down-to-earth program that may reduce recidivism in a women's prison in Chowchilla.
And it's no coincidence soccer is wildly popular in the San Joaquin Valley. A historian connects the dots between the sport and the Valley's migrant history. For Earth Day, we zoom in on climate change, and we get a preview of Johann Sebastian Bach's St. John Passion to be performed by the Fresno Community Chorus this weekend.
But we start near Bakersfield as part of In Recovery, our ongoing series on opioids produced as part of a data journalism fellowship from the USC Center for Health Journalism. In 2015, residents of the community of Oildale died of opioid overdoses at a higher rate than anywhere else in the county. But in 2016, those numbers plummeted to the lowest they'd been in years. Why? Well, I'm going to take you to Oildale now, where some say it's community advocacy and others say better access to medical treatment. But whether the improvement can last remains to be seen.
There's a great illness here. It's the opiates.
Charlie Huddleston knows opiates. He came across them after a broken childhood.
My father beat me so intensely when I was 6 years old that he gave me brain damage, so they say.
By the age of 10, he says he was skipping school and getting in trouble. It was only a few years later, in juvenile prison, that he was exposed to drugs.
I've went most of my life loaded on heroin, till I was 53.
He's now 59, and helping others recover, in a county where thousands of people are hooked on heroin and pain pills, and few are in treatment. Not to mention another rampant drug problem, methamphetamine. Huddleston wears a t-shirt of a verse from 1 Corinthians over broad shoulders and tattooed sleeves. He's a trucker. But when he's not on the road, he donates his time to Keepers of the Cross, a motorcycle ministry that runs a community hub on Oildale's main drag. Christian rock wafts out the front door of the yellow building where the Keepers host sermons, health clinics, free meals, and they're building a women's shelter.
We just go into the streets and we just tell people, hey, Jesus loves you. We give them a water, we give them food. We do all kinds of outreach in the trenches of the opiate world.
Huddleston's seen heroin kill friends, family members, an ex-wife. He says he tried dozens of recovery programs. Some helped temporarily, but what finally did work was religion. He remembers one particular church service in 2013.
And when I hit my knees on that altar, it felt like my whole life had come out my eyes. It felt like I cried away every pain, every heartache, and everything. And that's the day that my life started changing.
In March, he reached 6 years sober. He says being a keeper is what keeps him clean.
When I surround myself with the keepers, pastors, parishioners from churches, different churches, I'm held accountable.
So just be careful when you're walking because you are in soft shoes. Watch for needles.
A few streets away, Donna Clopton picks up trash in Beardsley Park. It's for the Oildale Prevention Partnership, which she runs when she's not working as a security guard. She carries granola bars in her purse for homeless people.
Is it really that common to see needles
here?
Yeah,
maybe just one or two, but yeah.
Within 5 minutes, we find two syringes, one underneath a jungle gym.
And this is where the children play, so.
It has blood in it.
You know,
the other is missing a needle.
I don't know if they're hiding them so that they can come back and reuse them, or if it's just their way of disposing of them.
Clopton drops them in a plastic bottle. Alongside her, Dave Cadell rakes his feet through wood chips.
Just to make sure that there's nothing here, it's going to be a hazard for the kids.
He's wearing thick sneakers. Cadell is a retired sheriff's deputy and director of the Oildale Community Action Team. He's mild-mannered, used to lead a singing group at his church. He says drugs are the root of so many of Oildale's problems. Take crime. He says, imagine how much stuff users have to steal to sustain their habit.
Typically, it's going to be probably 10 cents on the dollar. So, you know, your $1,000 TV that they stole from you, they're going to get $100 worth of drugs for. You know, that's not going to help them for more than about 12 hours.
It's no wonder the Walmart on Chester Street locks up even its cheap merchandise, like toothbrushes and nail polish. Now, those struggling with opioids have easier access to treatment.
Hi, what's your name?
Fatal overdoses dropped in Oildale the year a new Aegis Treatment Center opened just across the river in northern Bakersfield.
She checked you in for your medication, so you can just go up to the dispensing window.
Regional Director Javier Moreno says it's Aegis's second location in the city, after another on 21st Street.
We noticed that our 21st Street location was seeing a huge increase in patients from northern part of Bakersfield, so it only made sense to open up a treatment center closest to that pocket of patients.
Aegis offers medication-assisted treatment using methadone and buprenorphine, or Suboxone. Moreno says about a third of this clinic's 350 patients come from Oildale. Moreno's in a room used for art therapy. Post-its cover the door, written with patients' goals. Things like being free from addiction, never having to use pills again, a family for my son. Moreno mentions a longtime patient he just ran into.
He just graduated with a Bachelor's of Science in Information Technology. And he's working for a San Diego-based IT company. I mean, we get to hear these stories on a daily basis. And for us, it's a daily reminder that what we're doing works.
But at the same time, Oildale's ER visits from opioids are up. Moreno offers one hypothesis why.
It's pretty evident what's happening right now is that providers are, you know, fearful to write scripts. And they're, you know, just leaving patients to fend on their own.
Meaning some addicted to pain pills may turn to street drugs like heroin and the super concentrated fentanyl. So is Oildale's opioid problem getting better or worse? A county health official tells me it's just too early to tell, partly because fentanyl hasn't yet clobbered California the way it has the East Coast. However, she does say Oildale's community groups seem to be leaving a mark. Like Charlie Huddleston's group, Keepers of the Cross.
Do I feel like I'm making a difference? I believe my part in it is making a difference, yeah. I believe we reach a lot of people.
But he can't reach everyone. Three of his six siblings died of heroin overdoses. His last surviving brother uses heroin, lives on the streets. Huddleston carries a change of clothes and pair of shoes for the next time he sees him.
But you just gotta love them until they love themselves. And I think that's the basis of beating addiction is loving yourself.
The next question is, will the rest of Oildale love itself? With Valley Public Radio, I'm Carrie Klein.
The sound of a shovel hitting the dirt, the feeling of the earth in your hands, the joy of watching plants flower and grow. Gardening is just plain old therapeutic. Reporter Monica Velez takes us to a garden in Chowchilla that is giving women the chance to nurture and heal.
In the garden, women pull unwanted weeds out of the dirt. Some use their bare hands, others wear gloves. There are wildflowers, succulents, lavender, thyme, and perennials. 33-year-old Sol Mercado helped design this garden a year and a half ago.
And we were just like building everything from scratch. Like we had mulch in our eyes, we had, you know, like dirt. It was really high, but we still pushed through and we got it done. You know, we were all working as a team and it was really nice.
Mercado and a group of about two dozen women garden every Friday afternoon to escape the monotony of the concrete walls and barbed wire where they reside. Mercado has lived here for almost 15 years. In one of the largest women prisons in the country, the Central California Women's Facility, or CCWF.
I committed my crime when I was a day after my 19th birthday. I shot and killed a rival gang member.
Mercado says she was just 12 when she joined a gang. Her parents split when she was three. She endured sexual and domestic abuse, and she turned to the streets as a way to cope, or what she refers to as a path of destruction.
There's no justification, no excuse for what I did. I can't blame it on him. I can't blame it on nobody. But I made a lot of bad choices. And at that moment, I didn't care about nobody or myself.
Mercado was sentenced to 31 years, but she will get a parole hearing by 2021. And while she's in here, she says she's starting to find some purpose. She has a second chance and says she's trying to honor the life she took.
Doing activities like this, I learn a lot about myself. And I challenged myself to do things that I never done before, and that nobody ever told me, hey, you can do this, you got this, you know. I never had any encouragement out there. It was always encouragement to do the bad things.
The warden at CCWF, Janella Spinoza, says the garden gives the women a sense of worth.
I tell them, use prison as a platform to transform your life.
The garden is part of the Insight Garden program, a nonprofit that aims to connect people in prison with nature, the community, and themselves. Once a week, women garden, then they meditate and end with a two-hour class. They learn about the environment and work on personal development. The program is in 9 other California prisons. Beth Wakis, the executive director of Insight Garden, says the program also provides resources for people once they're released.
So that when they leave, they have the resources and support they need, and we want to be there for them. I think that, you know, the majority of the people that we work with don't come back, and they become productive leaders in their communities, and that's what we're striving for, is to send them back and really have meaningful work and meaningful relationships and meaningful connections with the people they love.
The likelihood is high that people who are incarcerated will end up in jail or prison again. This program tries to change that. Over an 8-year period, the program followed 118 people who were released from San Quentin, where the program started. Wakis says only 11 returned to prison or jail within 3 years. Dina Velasquez is sitting in a white gazebo by the entrance to Community Regional Medical Center in downtown Fresno. Velasquez says she comes here sometimes to meditate and reflect.
For somebody like us, it would be like you really have to know how to cut out the outside noise.
When you say somebody like us, what do you mean by that?
Someone that's been incarcerated. Because when you're incarcerated, you don't hear all the noise of the cars, the birds. You know,
Velasquez was in prison for second-degree murder. She did 33 years and just got out in December. She says the Insight Garden program gave her a different perspective.
During that time is that they brought freedom to me. They brought freedom to me because now I had access to different types of plants that were out here in the real world. It brought me a piece of home.
The program connected Velasquez to organizations that are helping her reintegrate into society. The RAND Corporation, a research center organization focused on public policy, says rehab programs like the Garden can help reduce recidivism. But they must take into account the types of issues those who are incarcerated face. These include substance abuse and antisocial personality or temperament. Back at CCWF, Norma Sanchez digs up some weeds in the garden. She says she joined the Insight Garden program for the credits, which shaved time off prison sentences when accumulated. But now it's more than that. She says her daughter is learning about plants in elementary school. That is something that connects them regardless of the distance. They even swap stories about how their plants are growing. Sanchez says it helps her have a relationship with her daughter. She's been in prison for 7 years and has 6 more to go. She's in here for attempted murder. For her, gardening is a privilege. The way her life was going, she never would have had the chance to learn about plants on the outside. But now, she says, when she gets out, she's going to start her own garden. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Monica Velez.
The 35th class to participate in a yearly program to boost community leaders in Fresno is about to graduate. But before that, they must finish a group project that benefits the city. Here to tell us more about the Chamber of Commerce's Leadership Fresno program is Sarah Fraunheim. She's with the St. Agnes Medical Center Foundation and is the project manager and president for this year's leadership class. FM89's Alice Daniel starts by asking her to explain why the program exists.
It doesn't necessarily build leaders. We're all leaders in our own right, but it helps us be better community members by educating us on the industries that are really important in Fresno and allows us to have the tools necessary to be catalysts in our community to better Fresno.
Is it kind of like a crash course in understanding how a city works?
It kind of is. I would say that each day, so how it works is it's an 8-month-long program. It begins with a 2-day retreat, and that's a crash course on how to get along with 24 other people because, you know, we're all kind of in this outside environment. We're away from our friends and our family, our work, and we have to get to know each other and we have to build these relationships rather quickly because we're going to be working on a class project together. And we have to really understand everyone's strengths, opportunities, so that we can really develop the best class project possible. But then we have 8 months essentially of class days. So each month there's one class day. And what that's going to do is that's going to allow us to have more knowledge so that we're out in the community as leaders. We are able to make decisions that are best for Fresno, that is most applicable to the needs that are here in our community.
So everyone in this group is already established professionally.
Yes.
So in a sense, it's a networking opportunity. It must also be tricky because my guess is there's some strong personalities there.
Oh, absolutely. I think that there's a lot of different personalities. There's some really strong personalities. There's some really passionate personalities. And then there's also some people that are a little bit more quiet and they've really come out of their shell.
Okay, so let's talk about the projects. Tell me about your class's project and how you decided on it.
So you begin talking about your class project at your retreat. And you just start throwing things at the wall and seeing what sticks. Everyone knows that there's a project, but there are people that come into the program knowing, okay, there's a project we have to do, and I'm really passionate about this, and I think this could make a difference in our community. And then you have some people that come in and go, I'm really not sure what we should do. Let's just think about it and talk about it, and let's just put all these ideas out, and we'll pick one. And so you're kind of balancing all of that. One idea that really stood out in our minds was sexual assault and domestic violence. And we knew that we wanted to make an impact with that messaging. We didn't know exactly what that messaging was going to look like, but we knew that that was something that was really important to our community.
And why was that the one that resonated?
I think that when we started talking about domestic violence and sexual assault in our community, we realized that there are a lot of misconceptions. And we realized that there are some of us, like myself, who have experienced sexual assault and domestic violence, and we felt that it was genuine for us to really be passionate about bringing education awareness to domestic violence and sexual assault.
You said there are misconceptions about sexual assault. What are some of the misconceptions?
I think that there are misconceptions that it's tied to certain demographics, that it's tied to low income, that it's tied to only females. We have someone in our class who worked for the Marjorie Mason Center, and she was absolutely instrumental in giving us some educational tools to really make sure that the class project that we developed really addressed those misconceptions.
So let's talk about the project quickly. It's coming up this week.
We're going to be having some PSAs that are going to air 5 segments to basically share different parts of domestic violence, sexual assault, talking about breaking the cycle, talking about what are the warning signs. And then on Friday the 26th from 12 to 1, we're going to unveil a pathway that we've been working on at Fresno State. And it's really a reflection pathway for not only for it to bring awareness to domestic violence and sexual assault, but really for survivors of domestic violence and sexual assault to walk that pathway and reflect on their journey and know that we have their back, we've thought about them, and we want them to know that they are supported and that they are no longer victims, but they are now survivors.
So you fundraise for this path. Each of you have to raise, you said, $1,000.
Mm-hmm.
And then you also participate by planting plants around it.
Mm-hmm.
You hire the contractor.
So we've developed a really great relationship with Fresno State, and they've been gracious enough to partner with us for this pathway. So they will be building this pathway. They have a designer that's come in, an architect that's come in and designed this pathway for us. And we're going to plant all of the plants. And we've thought about these plants, right? Because they've got to be drought resistant. They have to be pretty. So we put a lot of effort into this project, and we're really proud to see it all come together for this culmination and unveiling.
And I would imagine when you look at the statistics of domestic violence that there are people in your class other than yourself who have experienced this.
Absolutely. We have 2 class members that have come forward throughout this and shared their story with us. And it is profound. Just like I said, those misconceptions, you would never think that they would, you would never assume that they are victims. They have been victims of domestic violence and sexual assault. And one of them has turned her story into empowerment and messaging for other women. And a couple of us have remained a little bit more quiet and haven't shared our entire journey, but to know that there are those of us in the class that that feel this connection to the class project is really powerful.
And that it's more common than people let on.
Absolutely. And, you know, there's a lot of misconceptions, but one is that women and men can just walk away. And it's not always that easy. And so I think that for survivors to know that they have gotten out of that situation is a really powerful thing. And that's what this pathway is about. It's about celebrating those survivors.
Thank you, Sarah, so much for coming. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having us.
Leadership Fresno is accepting applications for the 36th class until May 17th. You can find more information about tuition costs and the interview process at fresnochamber.com.
Step inside the Fresno City Council chambers, and you'll likely find residents making public comments, rallying around issues of housing and health. And in some cases, these residents are persuading council members to change their minds about projects and policies. I spoke to Brianna Calix with the Fresno Bee about what social justice groups in Fresno may have to do with the latest boost in civic engagement. Brianna, you start your story with a line from Fresno City Council member Gary Bredefeld about class warfare starting just weeks ago. But you note that this movement of social justice groups has actually been a decade in the making. So can you explain what that means?
Definitely. So obviously, Fresno has a ripe history of social justice issues and matters, and people have been organizing around different things for decades and decades. But for my story specifically, I looked at a number of groups that kind of established here in Fresno starting 10 years ago. And a lot of those groups are funded by the endowment, the California Endowment. You know, you have Fresno Building Healthy Communities. You have Faith in Fresno, which in the past has been, you know, Faith in the Valley, Faith in Community. And ever since then, there's kind of been little new groups popping up here and there. And so when we talk about, like, well, this class warfare and social justice movement starting 10 years ago, that's what we're talking about, is these groups opening up here in Fresno starting around 2010, 2011.
And could you attribute the arrival of these groups to any one particular thing? You mentioned one of them's funded by the endowment. Is it just that there's money coming in and someone had an idea somewhere that Fresno's a good place for that?
Well, when you look at Fresno and you look at some of the main issues facing the city, it's really kind of ground zero for all of the major issues happening around the country and all of these movements that have, you know, been dominating national headlines. And they're all happening here in Fresno, too, at maybe at a different level. And so, you know, when I was interviewing Catherine Forbes, she's the women's program director at Fresno State. She kind of mentioned something that, you know, these groups are being funded and they're organizing around issues rather than candidates. And so that's why we kind of see something different happening here than what it's kind of been in the past.
Mm-hmm. And when you say ground zero for a lot of issues, you mean things like, you know, whether your health is determined by your zip code and, you know, what kind of green space we have and educational opportunity, those things, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Health is one of them. Definitely immigration is another one. Environmental justice. You know, we have a lot of environmental issues here, stuff like that.
And it seems like a lot of these groups have had some recent significant wins, like I'm going to mention the stop ordinance in city council, also, you know, getting the mayor's office to reconsider how they allocate SB1 funds for roads and transportation. Can you talk about some of the other successes that they've had throughout the years?
Yeah, so those were definitely some of the hot button items that happened right before we published our story. But if you go back and, you know, to 2010, you look at some of the things that these groups have done, you have, you know, the Concerned Citizens of West Fresno and Mary Curry and Bob Mitchell and those folks. And, you know, they really wanted to get the Darling plant out of their neighborhood. And they had, you know, wanted this for years, but it really took legal aid to kind of get them to that point and, you know, get the city council on board, get the rest of the city on board. So that wasn't one thing. And then you also have, you know, the slumlord issue, which is something that Faith in the Valley, Faith in Fresno really elevated that issue, especially after the Somerset apartment fiasco. So those were kind of issues that came before and a couple years ago. And, you know, when you look at all these issues, they're all connected and they're all, you know, it's kind of the same people behind them who are advocating for change. And they're the ones who are putting pressure on these elected officials and City Hall and other government agencies to change policies. And it's really like, you know, the quote from Sarah Reyes in the story, to change policies and systems.
That almost begs the question, you know, if it's the same people constantly coming up and saying, hey, something's wrong, something's going on, it almost makes you wonder, like, why is something wrong consistently in this community, in these communities? And that also makes me think of a series you did last year about the quote-unquote divide in Fresno. Mm-hmm. You did lots of community engagement with that project, heard from lots of people. Do you feel like these stories, that series and this story about social justice groups are connected in a way?
Absolutely. And that's kind of how this story was born, is I, you know, did that community engagement project and looked at the history of this divide in Fresno and some of the causes behind that, and, you know, with redlining and sprawl and just a lot of city policies over the decades that really are still continuing to affect Fresno today. When we open up the story, we talk about Gary Bredefeld talking about this class warfare. And in that same press conference, you know, in that same SB1 issue, there is this talk about equity versus equality. And when you talk about equity, like, South Fresno really has been neglected for so many years. And now we kind of see this tide where people in those neighborhoods are organizing and they're fighting back.
We've been talking to Brianna Kallix. You can find her coverage of the Fresno City Council in the Fresno Bee. Brianna, thanks so much.
Yesterday was Earth Day, and to commemorate, Fresno City College held a talk last night about how climate change is increasing the risk of wildfire. Here to talk about it is one of the speakers, Jerry Hinkle, an economist based in Northern California and a board member of the nonprofit Citizens Climate Lobby.
So it was made crystal clear in the most recent national climate assessment that just came out last fall. Climate change is the predominant source of this significant increase in wildfire risk that we've seen. It was a source of half of the acreage burnt from 1984 to 2015. So the lesson there is, yes, there are other factors like forest management practices, but if we don't do something about climate change, given that temperatures are expected to increase significantly, if we don't do a lot to combat it, wildfire risk is going to increase by multiples in my children's lifetime.
And so, of course, a lot here is at risk. I mean, we're not just talking about land, uninhabited land being burned, but of course, there are developments, there are people's lives at risk, things like that. So there's a lot at stake here.
Just ask the folks in Paradise and in Santa Rosa and Napa. No, we're pretty much all at risk, including here in the valley. And don't forget the possibility of much worse air quality. In November last year, as we showed in our presentation, air quality here in California was the worst in the world. And, you know, Beijing and Mumbai and the like usually present some pretty tough competition, but it was not safe to be outside here. And if we get regular wildland fires in this state going forward, living here simply will not be the same. And that is what we are on track for.
So is this a cause for despair? I mean, what can we take from this discussion?
Not at all. So Citizens Climate Lobby is, we are behind the eight ball. But last year, our bill, the Energy Innovation Act, was introduced on a bipartisan basis in both the Senate and the House. It has been reintroduced on a bipartisan basis in the House of Representatives this year, and we're up to 32 co-sponsors. So we have real momentum. There is general consensus as to how to approach this. Make polluting more expensive, as we did say with cigarettes, and that's hard for the economy, though. But if you return all the funds to the American household, it's actually good for the economy. It actually grows jobs. So we know what to do. We have a political issue here. Citizens Climate Lobby and others are really making strides to get on the other side of that political issue.
And so there's some legislation currently in the works right now. What can the average person do when they hear this kind of conversation or read about it?
You're certainly welcome to join Citizens Climate Lobby. We have a fabulous Fresno chapter. But join with someone. Have your voice be heard. This democracy can work. But if you understand that this risk for you and for your kids is unacceptable, and that we have a commonly agreed, fair, simple solution, and that what is needed is just some impetus, a little press into the political process. Stand up, have your voice be heard, let your representative know.
And so talk a little bit more about this nonprofit, the Citizens Climate Lobby you've been talking about. You know, you're an organizer, you're also on the board of directors.
Yes.
What does the group do? And you're an economist. What brought you to it?
I have been working in climate change since 2001 and working with many of the majors, and they're great and do great stuff, but always attracted to market-based solutions. What we do is we can take the individual and help them to optimize their impact on the political process. We just have a great structure for that. And one of the unique elements of our work is that we come at each conversation with respect and appreciation for the view of others. And we try to find common ground. You know, we've made our trademark by working with Republicans. Last year, we got four Republicans to sign on to this very strong climate legislation.
So given your particular background and this talk you've been preparing, you know, is there anything that you think is missing from the public discourse on climate change?
Yeah. People understand that weather has become more extreme and that it's likely climate change. What they don't understand is that if we begin to come together and take action, say, globally, we meet the promises made to the Paris Accord, that the temperature increase will be multiples of what we've seen. So global average temperatures are up 1 degree centigrade, and they will go up well over 3 degrees centigrade. This is the most urgent issue that I can think of for this generation. That's why it's the students and the young that have really begun to stand up and make their voices heard. And we applaud that and encourage it from everyone.
Okay, well, Jerry Hinkle is an economist, a board member for Citizens Climate Lobby, and he spoke at Fresno City College last night for Earth Day. Jerry, thanks so much.
You're very welcome. Thank you so much for helping us get this message out.
This Friday, the Valley Public History Initiative at Fresno State is debuting Roots and Roots, Fresno's global soccer history. And that's Roots, R-O-O-T-S, and Roots, R-O-U-T-E-S. It's a project documenting the sport through oral histories, photos, and other documents, with a focus on Latin American immigrants who have made huge contributions to make soccer in Fresno what it is today. In our studios to discuss the project, we have Romeo Guzman, assistant professor of history at Fresno State, and Tyler Caffey, a Fresno State student himself. So, Romeo, starting with you, what was the impetus for this? Was there just a moment where you thought, we don't know enough about the history of this sport, or something else?
Yeah, I teach public history, I teach oral history, and I direct the Valley Public History Initiative. And I always tell my students that they should really research and write what they love. And I've been researching and writing the history of migration for about 10, 12 years, which I love. But at some point, I realized I should take my own advice and I should also do the things that I love. And I just accidentally got invited to a conference to talk about soccer. And as I was doing that, Tyler Caffey was also started digging into the history of soccer in Visalia. And then a bunch of other students got really excited. So really sort of it was just finally following my own advice, as well as my students sort of taking initiative and us coming together and deciding to sort of document the history of soccer in the Valley.
So almost a passion project that became sort of this true project that people are interested in that hasn't been documented before?
Yeah, it really hasn't. There's one book about soccer in the Central Valley, and it's like the 80s and 90s, which is really, really fascinating. But there definitely has not been any sort of thorough effort to document the history of soccer from its beginnings in the 1920s and then really when it explodes in the 60s and 70s and 80s. And one of the unique things about all our projects at the Valley Public History Initiative is that it's not Latino history, it's not like white history, right? It's always multi-ethnic. So while we've done a lot of work with Latinos, we just interviewed someone over at the Portuguese club. We're very excited to learn more about the Armenian soccer team. And ultimately, the history of soccer in the Valley is a history of the many ethnicities that come together to play soccer.
I want to share a clip from one person you interviewed for this project, Jaime Ramirez. He was the first coach of Fresno Fuego, which is the precursor team to today's Fresno Football Club, the Foxes. He was born in Mexicali, was undocumented in the U.S., but went to high school here and worked, and then ended up, after he graduated from high school, was working for a Japanese-American farmer and playing soccer at the time when a ref spotted him who was a Fresno Pacific coach. His name was Ben Norton. Norton asked if he could meet with Jaime, so they met up for dinner, and here's what Jaime says happened next.
You know, the first thing I said, hey, listen, coach, appreciate the meeting, but I just need to let you know that, you know, this is my situation. I don't have papers. Just wanted you to know. Well, I said, well, I would like to propose this. We're going to offer you an I-20 international student visa form to take to Tijuana, to the American consulate there, and seek a student visa to return.
Again, that was Jaime Ramirez talking about how Fresno Pacific coach Ben Norton offered him a chance to play at FPU with a student visa. Now, that's not where it ends, because Jaime's first attempt to get that visa was denied. But in hearing this story, it sounds like the sport became this opportunity for Jaime, an opportunity for education and even citizenship. Was that a common theme, or maybe a through line in a lot of the stories you heard, that soccer equated opportunity, or is soccer something different for different people in your oral histories?
No, definitely. That's definitely sort of a really smart sort of through line and point, and something that we keep hearing many, many times. And I think one of the really interesting things about Jaime is that he was, he's a migrant farm worker, and he learns a lot from this Japanese farmer. He doesn't play soccer in junior high. He plays soccer at Clovis, and he actually doesn't really get scouted. So he gets noticed because he's playing, for Ararat, the Armenian team, mm-hmm. and the ref happens to be the coach at Fresno Pacific. So the ref notices him playing on the Sunday League team, and that's how he gets picked up. So there's this way in which Jaime Ramirez has always sort of taken that to heart, both like Sunday League and what it means to sort of be part of the soccer community. It's not like a formal community in terms of like college universities, and also the strength and dignity and work ethic that folks are provided by being farm workers. So one of the things that Jaime has become known for is that he's created opportunities for other migrant farm worker children throughout the 80s, 90s, and 2000s. So one of the things that he told us about was that very early on, he would actually go to people's homes and speak to the parents in Spanish and explain to them, right, that they had laid the foundation for their children's future and success, and that he was just going to continue that, but in a different setting.
And then, so Tyler, turning to you, Romeo mentioned that you were interested in soccer. Can you talk a little bit about how you realized that could be your thesis or your project?
My first initial research on soccer was I had a friend that was doing commentary for the Fresno Fuego, and Dr. Guzman had us do a project, and I had asked him, my friend, Adrian Loveno, I said, do you know anybody I can interview over at the club? He said, oh, do you want to interview the general manager, Jeremy Schultz? I said, yeah, sure, let's set it up. I went over to Chukchansi Park, met him in his office. We talked for like a good hour and a half during the oral history interview. It was this really cool story where, because he started playing soccer in like the late 80s, early 90s. So his trajectory through the story that I told when I wrote the paper off of the oral history, it kind of paralleled like when the United States was starting to get the MLS and the Major League Soccer,
Okay. The
current professional, tier one professional league in the United States.
Wow. And so then, I guess, continuing through and being a part of the Roots and Roots project, did you conduct more oral histories or documentation? What was your role?
So after that, I applied for a research grant at Fresno State. I got that, and I started doing archival research at the Tulare County Library in Visalia. A lot of newspapers. I went through old yearbooks. And then I've conducted six oral histories. I just conducted two this last week. And through that, it's just, for me, it's fun because it's putting all of these things together and trying to make a story. And one of the first things I found out about my research on Visalia is the first team was started in 1967 by a man named Nahid Al-Askari, who's a migrant from Iraq. Turns out like his family was part of the governing bureaucracy. There was this really crazy story about it. Turns out he ended up in Visalia and there was no soccer team. So he had to ask, he taught at Mount Whitney High School, and he had asked them, can I start a soccer team? And they laughed at him because nobody played soccer there, you know, it's a football country. And for 2 years, he just begged them. And then finally, 1967, they, all right, you could start a team. And it was just a really crazy story. And then it ended up, that's what started the soccer in Visalia. And then from there, it just grew and grew and grew.
That sounds so funny now when you say people laughed at him back then, but soccer is so popular everywhere now that that would almost be laughable in and of itself.
Exactly.
And so I want to bring up another couple of people you guys interviewed, Tony and Francisco Alvarez. They're two founders of the Fresno Fuego team. They knew Jaime Ramirez. We don't have time to play clips from them, but I wanted to ask, do you think Fresno soccer would be what it is today if those two individuals or even Jaime Ramirez hadn't come along?
No, definitely not. I mean, I think they're truly pioneers. And I think the other thing that's really unique about Jaime and also Francisco and Tony is that they're bringing soccer universes together through the Fuego. So the Fuego is possible because there was a really strong adult league here, and that adult league dates to 1958. And in 1960, you have a team called Club Mexico, which is composed of predominantly Mexican players. From 1960 until, you know, when the Fuego was founded, Club Mexico was a solid, solid team, right? So what Fuego did really was it provided a space for these adult league players to play, provided a space for Fresno Pacific, for Fresno State players. It provided a place for even really talented high school players. And I think that was the first time that you had a team that could sort of bring all these different soccer universes together. And of course, Jaime and the Alvarez brothers were foundational to that.
And so this project overall has been a year in the making. And turning to this weekend's event, what is the culmination of this? What can attendees expect?
On Friday night, right before the Fresno FC game, it's a Fuego throwback. And we're going to have a panel with former Fuego players and coaches and managers right before the game at Tioga Sequoia. So folks that are interested in learning more about the history of soccer here can sort of learn about the origins of Fuego and its development. And then on Saturday, we're going to have a series of panels. We'll have a panel on fandom with all the fan clubs from the Fresno FC, so the Fire Squad will be there, the Vigilantes will be there, the Skulk will be there, and we're going to ask, what is fandom? But also we're going to ask, what should we expect of our club, right? So what expectations do we have? Do we get to set the priorities for what we expect from our club? Right now, the big debate is where the stadium is going to be. So like,
where the stadium is going to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so do we as fans have a say in that? And if they leave Fresno, do we have a say in what that stadium should look like? Mm-hmm. So questions like that. We'll also have a panel on women's soccer. We'll have very prominent players and coaches that will discuss the future and past of women's soccer. And then we'll also have a keynote by Josh Nadell, who just wrote a book with Brenda Elsley about the history of soccer, women's soccer in Latin America. And of course, one of the things that we always do is we always structure our events to have what we call walk-in oral histories. So one of the things that we learn is the more we learn, the more we figure out what we don't know. So for example, you know, the Armenian community, even the history of the Fuego, right? There's so many people that were fundamental to that. We still don't really know that entire history. So we're hoping to encourage folks to contribute, and we're hoping to do that by in two ways. One is on Friday, we'll likely pass out trading cards, brand new trading cards of important players and coaches. And then on Saturday, anyone who gives us an oral history or who brings a photograph that we can scan will be entered into a raffle to win a brand new t-shirt that we're going to unveil on Friday.
We've been speaking to history professor Romeo Guzman and student Tyler Caffey, both at Fresno State, about Roots and Roots, Fresno's global soccer history. The event is Friday and Saturday, a culmination of documenting soccer's history in Fresno and the Central Valley. You can find more info about this online from the Valley Public History Initiative at Fresno State. They have a Facebook page and event details all there. I want to say thank you both for coming in and telling me about this.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Right on the heels of Easter, the Fresno Master Chorale concludes its season with an epic work by Johann Sebastian Bach. FM89's David Aus spoke with artistic director Anna Hamre and soloist Terry Lewis about their upcoming concert.
The next performance of the Fresno Master Chorale is Sunday, April 28th at the Paul Chagoyan Concert Hall at the Clovis Performing Arts Center. Concert starts at 2:30 p.m. There's a pre-concert talk at 1:30, and the program is St. John Passion by Johann Sebastian Bach. This is a notable event because this is the first time in 50-some-odd years that this work's been performed in Fresno.
Yeah, over 50 years, yeah. Closer to 60.
Do you know that last one, was it performed in English or in the original German?
Our records don't show that.
Interesting.
Yeah,
okay.
I need to ask around.
So the work originally composed in 1724 when Bach was...
At Leipzig,
At Leipzig, correct. Why does this work matter?
This work matters, first of all, because it's an extraordinary composition, one of the great masterworks of civilization. It's a profound piece of music theater that we sometimes think of just as a concert piece, but it's really a music theater piece. He intended it that way. So the composition is extraordinary. What we find interesting is the more we studied it, the more subtle messages there were for society today.
So maybe you can talk about some of those themes, because you said it's nearly 300 years old, 295 years old, but it raises important questions and issues of today.
Right, right. For example, the one that is so striking comes with the crowd scenes, and the crowd scenes become violent. They become so agitated. They're easily misled. And they cry for something that they may not even really want, but they get wrapped up in the moment. It's an amazing thing to observe, and I think we see that a lot these days.
Good point. Good point. There's so many different kinds of singing forms.
Right.
And an oratorio has elements of kind of several.
Yes, exactly.
So it's not strictly a concert piece.
No.
It has elements of opera, though it's not exactly an opera.
Right.
So what makes it distinct from other vocal performance forms?
If you look at the score, the manuscript that Bach left, it says part one before the sermon, part two after the sermon. And the first part, it was about 35, 40 minutes long. And then the second half was actually, it's asymmetrical, it's actually closer to, an hour and 40 minutes or an hour and a half, something like that. And that means that there was a sizable sermon in the middle. So it would have been about a three-hour event. And Bach was a very religious man. He intended this to move hearts, to be a religious statement. But we put it in the concert hall now because we realize it's just such an extraordinary piece of music.
Compared to just a piece of choral work, there's not just a chorus on stage.
No, they're soloists. They act out the parts, and they probably did at the time of Bach. There probably were some props and some acting and maybe some costumes because they wanted to tell a really profound story.
So drama and theatrical elements come into play.
Exactly.
There's a symphony as well?
Yeah, that's right. There is a small orchestra that Bach wrote for. When he was first at Leipzig, he was very energetic. His output is extraordinary. And you see a lot of youthful excitement in this piece. So there's more drama. This is the most dramatic work he ever wrote.
Will there be staging, choreography?
There is a little staging. There's some blocking, but it's quite stylized. People know the story. It's a very interesting thing to put on a show where everyone knows how it's going to end. And so we have to try to find a different take on it and give a little different interpretation. So there will be some staging. We have the benefit of a little bit of lighting possibilities.
Now, I did some study on oratorio, and oratorio got sort of a boost, I read, in Italy at one point where the church during Lent
Shut
down the theaters, right?
Right.
So no opera, we'll have none of this.
That's right.
And so this became kind of, oratorios became kind of a cheat.
Exactly.
And a substitute form of entertainment for the traditional opera-going audiences, right?
Exactly right. They would just take the theater into the church and do a little less of the theatrical kind of stuff. But it should be noted that they were often very theatrical. In fact, Bach got roundly criticized for being so theatrical with his performances of the Passions.
How many solos do you have in this piece?
There are five major solos and three less aggressive solos.
And we have one of those soloists here, Terry Lewis. And Terry Lewis, this is the part of a lifetime.
That's right. With a lot of pressure.
That's right. So which role do you play in this part?
I play Jesus.
Anything special to go about performing, preparing for this role?
Is there literally any person you could play that's more iconic? No. Our stage director, Allison Windmiller, has a very specific sort of take on it. And as Anna mentioned before, it's very stylized. So there's still real emotion there. There's still real connection and a sense of the humanness of everyone involved. But it's also physically, it's very stylized just because of the nature of the work. And that seemed to work the best for what we were doing. There's a lot of sort of how much of the man do you play, how much of God do you play, you know, that sort of finding the balance there. So we're still sort of working it out in rehearsals.
Are there clues or cues in the music that help you navigate that path?
Well, it's interesting because Jesus actually in this, he's not one of the main quartet of soloists. There's a soprano, alto, tenor, bass. Jesus is also a bass part, but he doesn't have any arias proper. Everything he does is recitative. what Bach has done, it's so, Jesus is very theatrical. So he's got singing to do, but of the soloists, he's the smallest in terms of the vocal demand. So it really is more of a kind of an acting piece. And what we found as we're going through this is that everything he does is reactive. Everything that he does is as a reaction to what someone else does, really, with a, maybe just a couple of moments of exception. It's an oddly passive sort of role, but it's a very, very interesting take on Jesus.
Is this a challenging work for a chorus?
Yes, it certainly is. Actually, besides the evangelist, the largest role is the chorus role. Those are called turba choruses. These are the crowd scenes where they call for the release of Barabbas, or they will call for the crucifixion or something. So they're very aggressive, and boy, this is some of Bach's most difficult counterpoint. So the choir has been working very hard at this, and I was so pleased to see that even though they had this week off with Holy Week, they had sectionals on their own, and so they were working.
Well, because there's no skating and flying under the radar in
no
a piece
skating
like this.
And Bach.
How many members in Fresno Master Chorale for this performance?
We have about 160 singers.
It's going to be a full stage.
It's going to be a very full stage. You know, and as we, when Bach performed it, his chorus would have been about 30 singers, and they would have been boys, young men. And so this is really not what he envisioned in that sense. I should add that so that the audience understands a little bit of the timbre Bach would have had in mind for the singers, we are bringing on the Rayburn Chamber Choir to be with us, so they'll at least hear some of those youthful voices.
Excellent. Because this is a very different blend of textures than
a
huge set of adult voices across bigger ranges. How big's the orchestra?
The orchestra is basically a little string orchestra plus woodwinds and pairs, oboes, flutes, and one bassoon. The continuo carries the biggest chunk of the work, and that's the cellist and the organist.
So that's coming up on Sunday, April 28th at the Paul Chagoyan Concert Hall at Clovis Performing Arts Center. Performance starts at 2:30, and then if you get there early, there's a pre-concert talk, right?
At 1:30.
At 1:30. Dr. Anna Homrie, Terry Lewis, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, David.
Thank you for having me.
And that's today's Valley Edition. You can find all this and more on our website, kvpr.org. You can also download the podcast. We're on Facebook and Instagram at Valley Public Radio and on Twitter at KVPR.
Don't forget to check out our app. It's called KVPR, and it's available for free on iTunes and Android. The show is produced by me, my co-host Carrie Klein, reporter Monica Velez, and our news director Alice Daniel.
Technical support from Marv Allen and Don Weaver. I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Laura Satsui. This has been Valley Edition. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, accepting nominations now for the 2020 James Irvine Foundation Leadership Awards at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, featuring Listening to Mothers in California, a new survey with insights into maternity care in the Golden State, on the web at chcf.org.